What is behind Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper's fawning over the state of Israel during his recent visit there? How does the Harper government's stance toward Israel compare with that of previous governments? Does Canada benefit economically and militarily from Israel's repressive policies? What is behind the tendency of Harper and other parliamentarians to conflate legitimate criticism of Israeli policies with charges of anti-Semitism? On the occasion of the Canadian Prime Minister's recent visit to Israel, the Global Research NewsHour examines the history of Canadian policy toward Israel, Canada's role in supporting and benefiting from Israeli apartheid, and the intelligence behind invoking anti-Semitism in critiques of Israeli apartheid, with guests Eve Engler, Richard Saunders, and Michael Kiefer. On today's program, Through Fire and Water, Canada Backs Israeli Apartheid. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of February 21st, 2014. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major stories shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. Our show is also podcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. What has happened that explains the transformation of the UK and all of its former English colonies, the US, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, into Gestapo Stasi states? These are the countries best known historically for their domestic civil liberties and rule of law, irrespective of their treatment of their indigenous populations and, in the case of England, her non-white colonies. Today, the governments of the US, UK, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, the Five Eyes, see civil liberty and the accountability of government to law as threats to themselves, and the governments are determined to stamp out the threats. What has occurred in the US and UK is that the criminal and treasonous acts of both governments have become so extreme that the governments must destroy civil liberty in order to protect themselves from exposure. Whenever you hear national security invoked, you know that government is covering up its crimes and its lies. That's from the article American Stasi Police State Staring Us in the Face by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, posted February 19th, originally appearing at paulcraigroberts.org. The Sandy Hook school shooting was a giant elaborate hoax and no one really died. That's the conclusion Wolfgang Halbig, a former educator, U.S. Customs agent, and Florida State Trooper, has reached after 10 months of investigation and multiple disputes with federal, state, and school authorities. Halbig is convinced a deluge of discrepancies prove that the whole scenario was a scripted event. His job is to help schools prevent incidents like the one that unfolded in Newtown. In order to do that, he needs to know exactly what happened at Sandy Hook. But school, state, and federal officials aren't making his job easy, and the states even threatened him for meddling in their affairs. That's from the article, School Shooting Expert Threatened Over a Sandy Hook Investigation, Was Told If He Didn't Back Off, Bad Things Are Going to Happen, by Adan Salazar, posted February 19th, originally appearing at Infowars.com. There is a noted similarity in the protest movements in Syria and Ukraine. There is evidence of armed gunmen among protesters in Kiev targeting policemen. Quoting from Russian information agency Novosti, February 19, 2014, at least 25 people, including 9 police officers, were killed in bloody day-long clashes that ran into the early hours of Wednesday morning in the Ukrainian capital. Officials said more than 70 policemen suffered gunshot wounds in the fighting. In his address to the nation Wednesday, Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych said that, opposition activist had crossed the line by calling for supporters to take up arms at mass protests intended to oust him from power. That's from the article Blood in the Streets, West is Repeating Syrian Model in Ukraine by Rick Rozoff, posted February 19th, originally appearing on the Stop NATO website. The avalanche of liquidity from the Fed's quantitative easing in 2013 allowed the world's before's tenets to wake up. Indebtedness, bubbles, globalization, financialization. But all it took was a slight slowing down in the astronomical amounts injected by the U.S. Central Bank every month for the rampant crisis buried under these piles of liquidity to reassert itself. As anticipated, the method of resolving the crisis by accentuating the excesses that caused it is ineffective, causing a crisis squared instead. The timing belt of this renewal of the crisis is primarily driven by tapering, the reduction of the Fed's QE program, which, as we know, has immediately led to the tremors in emerging currencies. Beyond the negative impact that that has on the global economy, our team anticipates that these shocks will cause a boomerang effect on the U.S. and finally unleash the chain of events of the dollar's massive devaluation, destabilizing everything that remains of the old system of which it's the cornerstone. That's from the article, The Global Systemic Crisis, Quantitative Easing and the Fed's Tapering Will Trigger a Boomerang Effect, from Global Europe Anticipation Bulletin number 82, posted February 19th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Prime Minister of Canada had taken part in a four-day visit of Israel last month. Joining him was a delegation of more than 200 people, including a range of civil society organizations, religious leaders, and business executives. He received an honorary doctoral degree from Tel Aviv University, toured a number of biblical sites, and serenaded the Israeli Prime Minister with a spirited rendition of the Beatles classic Hey Jude. He became the first Canadian Prime Minister ever to address the Israeli Knesset and express sentiments linking criticism of the State of Israel and its apartheid-like policies with anti-Semitism, drawing the ire of many, including the Deputy Speaker of the Knesset. The Harper government's full-throated siding with Israel abandons any pretense of a balanced approach toward Middle East policy. Just how distinct is Canada's stance with regard to Israel and the pro-Zionist policies generally? Joining us to examine this history is Eve Engler. Eve Engler is a Montreal and Ottawa-based activist and the author of several books on Canadian foreign policy. You were particularly critical of Stephen Harper, the Stephen Harper government. Let's talk about their foreign policy towards Israel. Is it really as unprecedented as we've we're largely led to believe by both progressive and commercial media?
It is extreme. It's definitely unique. It's new in terms of being this pro-Israel. They've definitely deepened Canada's pro-Israel tendency, but it's not just a historic aberration. It's not like previous governments were actually honest brokers, as is often formulated. You can go back to Lester Pearson's time when he was external minister in, from the late 40s to the mid 50s, and
liberal prime minister
and then prime minister in the 60s after that. Lester Pearson played an important role in the partition of Palestine at the UN and pushing the partition plan that was bitterly rejected by Palestinians, and that gave the Zionist movement most of historic Palestine, even though there was less than a third of the population. Without a doubt, Christian Zionist thinking and British imperial thinking is what began Zionism in this country, because Zionism in this country doesn't begin as a Jewish movement. It begins as a Christian movement. In the late 1800s, there was a Christian Zionist movement, just as there was in Europe, and European Zionism doesn't begin with Theodor Herzl and the from the Jewish community. It just goes back to the Protestant Reformation and the more literal readings of the Bible that came out of the Protestant Reformation. And in this country, in the late 1800s, a preeminent Zionist, Christian Zionist, was a man by the name of Henry Wentworth Monk, who called for a dominion of Israel, similar to the dominion of Canada, as part of the British Empire. And he was a fairly prominent Ottawa business person and campaigned on the issue for decades. He claims he actually even influenced Lord Balfour with the infamous Balfour Declaration. That's probably debatable. With time, larger segments, growing segments of the Jewish community came to support Zionism and then obviously Israel later on after the creation of the state. But the roots definitely go back to a Christian and British imperial thinking. And until today, you bring it forward to today, one of the things you saw with Harper's visit to Israel, most of the focus, the critical focus, was that, this was just Harper pandering to the Jewish community and trying to win some votes in a couple of ridings where there's, somewhat significant number of Jewish people. Personally, I think that's very much overblown. There's obviously a couple ridings where there's, 20% of the voters are Jewish. There was also some comment about how Harper's evangelical background, and Christian Zionism has different currents to it, and has taken on a very, in today's terms, taken on a very kind of right wing evangelical. At the most extreme, that all Jews need to return to the Middle East, and then there'll be the second coming of Jesus, and then Jews will have to decide if they convert, or they get, or they burn in hell. What is that? Ultimately quite an anti-Semitic, thinking. So there was some comment about Harper's pro, sort of trying to, pander to the Jewish community or try to mobilize his evangelical base. There was almost no comment about how, what I think is still continues to be an important component of Canada's pro-Israel policy, which is that Israel, and this is articulated internally in 1947 when Canada was involved in UN discussions about the creation of Israel, and was articulated in the mid-1950s by Lester Pearson, then the External Affairs Minister, again internally, that Israel was seen as a bastion of Western power in the Middle East, and that it was basically a geopolitical ally. That is basically not discussed when talking about Harper's pro-Israel policy, and I think it's not a coincidence that the most pro-Israel forces within this country are also tend to be the most pro European, North American, Western imperialist governments. I think that's an important component of Harper's pro-Israel policy that doesn't get discussed, and there's a long history there. Whether what proportion of this pro-Israel policy is because of a trying to woo Jewish voters, trying to mobilize the evangelical base, and being, pro-imperialist, I think you can have a debate about exactly, what percentage is the motivating factor. But I think that's, those three are important components of this Harper's pro-Israel policy.
Mm. I'm curious to know if the Canada's approach, rapprochement with Israel, is distinct from the United States' rapprochement with Israel. Since we have so many progressive-minded people in this country, particularly saying that we're just holding the bully's quote, is the title of one of such book, where basically our foreign policy is just, doing what the U.S. tells us to do. To what extent is Israel, our Canada's relationship with Israel, is it completely distinct from the United States, or is there an influence there? How do you see that?
Well, I'd say that over the past 40, 50 years, it's been pretty close to what Washington's position has been, a tendency within foreign affairs let's call it mimic or follow or want to be somewhat aligned with Washington's policy. That continues under Harper. What you do see under Harper is actually on a few issues, particularly on Iran, where Harper is to a certain extent, I would say, undermining Obama's negotiating position in the current context, and actually aligning with Netanyahu against, to a certain extent at least, against Washington and London's position. So you're seeing an even more extreme position. On the Palestinian question, to a certain extent, there's sort of complete refusal to criticize settlements. But I mean, the Harper government's refusal to criticize settlements is it could be seen as possibly undermining John Kerry's attempts to negotiate a solution. But the reality is that Washington doesn't seem to care about Palestinians all that much, and I don't think Harper's really much offline there. But I would say that before the creation of Israel in the early 1900s, Canadian political elite were more pro-Zionist than the American political elite, because Canada was part of the British Empire and Britain was the main patron of Zionism. I think that today, even as pro-Israel as Harper is, and extremely so, it's still obviously Washington that's the main financier of Israel, and $3.5 billion in aid, largely weaponry, that the U.S. Delivers to Israel is absolutely vital for Israel's pro-colonial, pro-aggressive policy in the region. I would say that there's no doubt that Washington's position is in the background in terms of understanding Canada's pro-Israel position. But I don't think it's as simple as just one-to-one.
Okay. Now, just to kind of like one of the memes going through that the Harper government is putting out, they talk about all the aid that goes to the Palestinians. They talked about $66 million going to the Palestinians. What about this idea that the Harper government, by virtue of their that aid that's going out to Palestinians, that's somehow going to balance the scales somewhat?
I mean, it's really an impressive feat of the dominant media to refer to the $66 million in aid, imply that it's about helping Palestinians, when we know we have internal CEDA documents. The Canadian International Development Agency, the head of CEDA, Margaret Biggs, from about a year ago now, she stated clearly that it's Israel that is pushing Canada to continue the aid program to the Palestinian Authority. And that even more so in this internal document that was reported on by Post Media, so it's in the public domain by a mainstream corporate media outlet, in this document that the president of CEDA said that one of the motivations for Canada's aid to the Palestinian Authority is that this aid is going for security reform. In essence, it's going to building a Palestinian security force under Mahmoud Abbas's leadership, the head of the Palestinian Authority, whose electoral mandate ended in 2009, who is widely seen as corrupt, who is seen as incredibly compliant in the face of ongoing Israeli settlement building by the vast majority of Palestinians. This aid that Canada delivers to the Palestinian Authority is designed, according to Margaret Biggs, the president of CEDA, to help the Palestinian Authority that is facing the emergence of popular protest. That's the words from the internal document, popular protest. And so basically what Canada is doing, through its aid to the Palestinian Authority, is building a security force that's trained by the U.S., Britain, and Canada in a facility, in part at least, in a facility that the Americans built in Jordan after invading Iraq, where they were training Iraqi security forces after the invasion of Iraq. And it's been well documented that this security force that Canada's building is designed to prop up the Palestinian Authority, partly in their battle, in their political struggle with Hamas, and partly to oversee Israel's occupation of the West Bank. Because, as we know throughout history, colonial authorities always prefer to have local officials do as much of the security work as possible. So in India, during British colonial rule in India, it wasn't British officers, it wasn't British soldiers that were the main on-the-ground military force maintaining colonial rule. It was Indians. Obviously, British officers were at the higher echelon and oversaw everything. But to the extent possible, colonial authorities want a compliant indigenous force to do as much of their dirty work as possible. And Israel is no different. And it wants compliant Palestinians to do this. It's all done. It's all justified on the grounds of state building and whatnot. And Canada's helping to build a Palestinian security force to, you know, prepare for the creation of a Palestinian state, etc. But what it really is about is supporting Israel's allies, in effect, in the West Bank. So when the corporate media refers to this as aid to Palestinians, it's a joke. It's comical. We know that Israel is the one prodding Canada to deliver aid, this aid to the Palestinians. So, it's just reflective of the complete unwillingness of the dominant media to investigate Canadian foreign policy critically. And actually, about 2 years ago, maybe it was even longer than that, the Pat Martin, who was the Globe and Mail's correspondent in the region, I prodded him on this issue, and this is before we had the internal documents even proving what the intent of the aid was. But I prodded him on the issue, and he got back to me and he said, "Yeah, this is an interesting story. Yeah, I should do something on this." 2 years later, I have yet to see the Globe and Mail investigate this issue seriously. But it's all part of a longer. It's not just on this issue. There's a long history of Canadian aid, be it in Haiti or in Afghanistan. It's a tool to advance Canadian foreign policy interests. To the extent that it helps people on the ground is often greatly exaggerated.
Okay, one last point I wanted to raise with you, because again, we're hearing all about Harper and the conservatives, and I think you've pointed out that there is this long tradition of the opposition, the liberals, and perhaps even the NDP being very supportive, having this pro-Zionist mentality, would you justify support, replacing Harper with another, the Liberals or the NDP, whose policies are apparently not that distinct from in the grand scheme of things, maybe not quite as offensively but.
There's absolutely no doubt that there is no political party in this country, none of the four top parties, including the Green Party, that has a policy that has a perspective on this issue that's anywhere close to justice for Palestinians. That is without a doubt. And there was a very good piece that a friend of mine, Drew Ojeje, wrote on the media co-op a couple of months ago, or I guess about a month and a half ago, when Elizabeth May, the head of the Green Party, attended the Jewish National Fund Ottawa's fundraiser, and in fact, I was outside, 50 or so, 70 of us outside protesting the Jewish National Fund, which has explicitly racist land covenants. It's an explicitly racist organization that has had a long history of dispossessing Palestinians. And Elizabeth May, at this event, made a comment about Israel making the desert bloom. I mean, this is, you know, way off in the la-la land of Zionist mythology that she was puppeting or repeating. And done a series of other things. I mean, the NDP, when Ariel Sharon died, who, you know, the UN has shown has got incredible amount of blood on his hand, particularly of Lebanese, and the massacre, the Sabra Shatila, massacre, you know, lots and lots of Palestinian blood on his hand, and incredibly, aggressive, Israeli, figure. And the NDP released a condolences and this important person for, Israel's history. To the victims of Ariel Sharon, somebody, the people would be completely appalled by NDP's position. And this isn't just a matter of because someone important died and, you know, a kind of, condolences, but, you know, when Hugo Chavez died, the NDP refused to release anything. I think history will judge us. Hugo Chavez was somebody who did a lot more for the cause of justice than Ariel Sharon. So the reality is in this country, and it's not new, it's long standing. All the parties have a pro-Israel policy. The NDP and the Greens are probably the least bad. They're far what I think is what we do see happening, and what I think is gives me some hope is that the distance between the grassroots position, those who are cognizant of the issue, their position of being critical of Israel, the growth of the boycott, divestment, sanctions campaign, the distance between the NDP and the Liberal and the Green Party's position and the grassroots position is becoming wider and wider. And I think that the vast majority of people who are active within those parties are sympathetic to the Palestinian cause. There is becoming this gulf between the sort of opinion of the leadership of the parties and the base, if you like. So I think that that's the reality is if we get to even Elizabeth May as prime minister in 2015, I don't think that the policy will be shifted in a way that comes even close to a pro justice policy, but it won't be as extreme as Harper, and I think that it's imperative that those of us who are not just doing the politicking, who are want to be for whatever calculation, electoral calculation or mainstream media calculation or just wanting to be perceived as a reliable agent of Canadian foreign policy, that those of us who are not concerned with that we keep standing up for justice and denouncing Canada's complicity in ongoing Israeli dispossession of Palestinians. And I think that the trajectory that we see on this issue is one where more and more people are cognizant, more and more people are taking action, and it's not too far in the future where we see a fundamental shift in the direction of Canadian support for Israeli apartheid.
Eve Engler, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Eve Engler is an Ottawa and Montreal-based activist and the author of several books, including The Ugly Canadian, Stephen Harper's Foreign Policy, and Lester Pearson's Peacekeeping, The Truth May Hurt. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Richard Saunders has been a longtime peace activist with the organization Coalition Opposed to the Arms Trade. He is also the publisher of Press for Conversion, a magazine which focuses on the theoretical and practical dimensions of converting the economic infrastructures dedicated to militarism toward those geared toward peacemaking. His most recent issues address how Canada, as he sees it, not only supports but profits from Israeli apartheid. We contacted him recently to explore his research further. Thank you for joining us, Richard Saunders.
Well, thanks for having me.
Okay, so we've explored the fact that the Harper government is clearly very close to the Israelis, but I'm wondering to what extent there's more going on here. And I know that you've written a couple of issues of Press for Conversion, which explores military and economic alliances. Do you want to explain that a little bit?
Well, in the past, I've done research on, particularly on pension plans, Canada's largest pension plans, including the Canada Pension Plan and the Quebec Pension Plan and various large union pension plans and other government pension plans that invest in military and intelligence companies that are supporting the government of Israel and its apartheid policies. This includes military companies, intelligence companies, security companies, police, prison-related technologies and products that companies around the world are selling to Israel that it's using to prop up the apartheid regime there. So Canada Pension Plan is just one of many ways that Canadians are forced to be complicit in this whole enterprise.
Could you break that down when you talk about Israel's apartheid system? I mean, what would you be referring to?
Well, there's some controversy over the use of that term, but it's basically just a system of keeping different groups within a country separated and to enforce different rules and enforce a system of injustice, which is not in any way democratic, but violates human rights and has one group of people in the country oppressing another. And, you know, there's been talk, when Harper went over there, he's talking about Canada and Israel being natural allies, and there's talk about, quote, shared values that Canada and Israel have, and I'll give you a quote. Harper said that Canada and Israel enjoy a special friendship based on freedom, justice, democracy, and the rule of law. And this is true in the sense, I mean, if you consider, if by that you mean two countries that are based on a kind of genocidal systems of apartheid where you have settler societies that are basically stealing land, occupying it, removing the freedoms from indigenous peoples and subjecting them to injustice and undemocratic systems, then yes, we do share a great history, and you can see what shared values they're talking about.
Can you give us an example of a company that or something that we're investing in that is propping up this apartheid system, as you call it?
Sure. Well, for example, Canada Pension Plan and other pension plans in Canada are investing millions of dollars in something called Paz Oil, the Paz Oil Company. That's an Israeli company. I'll give you a couple of examples if we have time here, but one of them could be Paz. Paz, which ironically means peace. It means in Spanish, but it means gold in Hebrew, and it's basically a fuel company. They sell billions of dollars worth of fuel to the Israeli Defense Force. So the Navy, the Air Force, the ground forces all use fuel for their vehicles, for their warplanes, for their tanks, from Paz Oil. And Canada is Canadian Pension Plan and other pension plans are investing in Paz Oil. So Paz is fueling the weapons that are being used in Israel and by Israel when it attacks neighboring countries. This only can happen because of the fuel that that's being supplied by this company, and that we're profiting from that. Canadians are forced to profit from that. Another example, last year Canada, the Canada Pension Plan pulled out of Elbit Systems, but prior to that it had invested in Elbit Systems, which is one of the biggest weapons-making companies in Israel. But there's also another example, which is NICE systems. The Canada Pension Plan is currently investing $5 million in NICE systems, which sounds nice, and the company's name is actually NICE, N-I-C-E. But what it is they produce wiretapping and surveillance products for many spy agencies, military institutions, police forces, and private companies around the world. So NICE systems products are used to intercept, record, and analyze vast amounts of information from all sorts of different sources, from multimedia sources like telephone calls, the web, radio, and video communications. So they provide intelligence organizations around the world and national security agencies with the software to process the analysis of vast amounts of communications, and they intercept, collect, process, and analyze vast amounts of data from all these different media sources and from communications. So that's, see, one of the things that Israel is right on the forefront of is this kind of communications interception and analysis, like intelligence gathering. They are at the top of the world in terms of spying technology. And there's been a lot of controversy lately over the National Security Agency. Well, they rely on intelligence companies like NICE, which was actually a spin-off from intelligence services in Israel, government intelligence spy institutions in Israel. Seven founders, the seven founders of NICE, were all members of the Israeli intelligence, and that's when they spun off from intelligence, the official intelligence agency, and which was the equivalent of the National Security Agency in the U.S., and started this company, NICE Systems. And Canada Pension Plan invests $5 million of our pension money into that company. We have no say in that, of course.
Now, are there other benefits for Canada other than these economic incentives?
Well, Israel has a huge military industry. They're a big exporter of military goods, of weapon systems. They're number two in terms of production of drones in the world, and as I said, intelligence gathering is also their forte. Canada has purchased Israeli military technology, including some drones that have been used that Canada used in Afghanistan. So these are surveillance drones. They're unmanned aerial vehicles. They are used in gathering intelligence. They can fly at several thousand feet. They can fly for 2 days at a time without refueling, and they're quite large, and they've been sold to Canada. Canada is currently looking into buying even more of this drone technology from Israel. Another thing that's Israel-Canada military connection is that the Israeli government, Israeli military industry called Elbit has a subsidiary called Elisra, and it makes electronic warfare equipment, and this electronic warfare equipment is being integrated into Canadian frigates. So Canada, it's important to know that Canada has a memorandum of understanding, an agreement with Israel since 2011, and what it does is it's an agreement to exchange classified information on military technologies. So research and development of military technologies is being integrated between Israel and Canada. And also we're sharing new technologies as well as this classified information. There's also cooperation in terms of counterterrorism, which is kind of a code maybe sometimes for repression. And also training, intelligence, command and control, and the Canadian Air Force is taking the lead on military cooperation with Israel. Israel has a very large Air Force of warplanes, fighters, bombers. It's equipped by the United States, of course. So the close ties between Canada and the U.S. and between Israel and the U.S., you know, the U.S. gives a couple of $1 billion worth of military equipment to Israel per year. So there's, that's another thing that we share in common, is a kind of subservience to the U.S. military empire.
Now, as you know, the world, well, much of the world has entered into this boycott, divest, sanction against Israel. How do you see that that kind of relationship, where you got Israel being kind of, on the one hand, being targeted this way by the EU and other countries, and yet Canada and the United States are moving in the opposite direction?
Yes. Well, on that score, when Harper gave his speech to the Israeli parliament, it was the first time a Canadian had spoken to the Knesset. Harper equated opposition to the Israeli government with anti-Semitism. He said there was he talked about a new anti-Semitism, which blames Israel for Middle East problems. And while he was giving his speech, one member of the parliament was heckling him. Everyone else there was cheering him on and everything, but there was one fellow there that was heckling him and shouting out about Israel being an apartheid government. He's on record for encouraging Canadians to boycott Israeli products that are used in the occupied territories, and he's calling on Canadians and others around the world to boycott anything that any companies that profit from that. So Canada is definitely moving in that. I mean, we're very strongly in the Israel camp, and we don't want to criticize Israel in any way, shape, or form. And that includes not, of course, supporting the boycott campaign, which is growing around the world, as you say.
Well, I think we're going to have to leave it there, Richard Saunders, but I want to thank you very much for sharing those thoughts with us.
Okay, well, thanks for having me on, and good luck with your program.
We've been speaking with Richard Saunders, who is the publisher of Press for Conversion magazine and also a coordinator of the Coalition Opposed to the Arms Trade. His website is coat.ncf.ca.
Stephen Harper, while he was in Israel, made a lot of commentary about the lamentable, in his eyes, views of how there's a lot of expression of anti-Semitism toward Israel and Israel bashing. The whole idea that criticism of Israel has become synonymous with anti-Semitism seems to be a recurring theme under his watch, and in fact across party lines. And so we're just going to explore that whole idea of this interpretation of anti-Semitism with Professor Emeritus Michael Kiefer. He's hails out of the University of Guelph and is a professor of literary studies. And he's also the author of the book Anti-Semitism, Real and Imagined. Michael Kiefer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the show, Michael.
Okay, now, do you want to tell us a little bit more about the whole manner in which this... was there a trigger by which we moved away from sort of a common sense idea that, you know, anti-Semitism equating like a racism against Jewish people, and now we seem to be moving into the realm of criticism of Israeli policy being equated with anti-Semitism? Would you like to address that point, please?
Yes. What Stephen Harper is doing is adopting an ideology, one can call it, of a so-called new anti-Semitism. which, as Norman Finkelstein wrote nearly a decade ago now, is really neither new nor about anti-Semitism. This notion was first advanced back in about 1974 by leaders of the Anti-Defamation League in the United States. And it's very explicit from the book that they wrote on the subject that what they were doing was to try to redefine the notion of anti-Semitism to incorporate criticisms of actions of the state of Israel, actions and policies of Israel, so that those criticisms could in effect be redefined as hate speech, and subsequent users of the new anti-Semitism rhetoric and ideology have basically been playing the same game ever since then. One could name, I did in the book, perhaps a dozen different books that are preaching the same line. There's a recent one by Daniel Goldhagen that's only just been published, and he's doing exactly the same thing, talking about a dangerous global resurgence of a new anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. And of course, what is involved here is really pernicious, because one must be frank. The real anti-Semitism does continue to exist, and it is vile. And in some countries, it is definitely resurgent. There is a resurgent neo-Nazism in Hungary, which is associated with at the state level, as well as in the news media and in the actions of paramilitary groups, with threats against and attacks on Roma people and on Jews in Hungary. So there are very disturbing things happening. But what this rhetoric does is to say, it's really an attempt, one has to say, to discredit international humanitarian law. Because, of course, under the Geneva Conventions, Israel is a violator of the conventions in its treatment of the Palestinians in the occupied territories. And Israel has been plausibly accused by United Nations commissions and by human rights groups, both of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Now, what the new anti-Semitism ideology tries to do is to say, when people say that, they are simply in a sophisticated manner giving a new expression to the ancient hatred of Jews. They would say, for Erwin Kotler, Canada's former justice minister, for example, has said this, that old anti-Semites would accuse Jews of poisoning wells, for example. There's one of the tropes of traditional anti-Semitism. And try and stir up hatred and persecution on that ground. The new anti-Semite, he says, is in the human rights organizations basically accusing Israel of poisoning the international wells. And the interesting thing is, of course, the metaphor is Kotler's. It's not, none of the human rights people talk in that kind of way. But it's an attempt to delegitimize human rights law and international law, which is really ironic and tragic in a way, because a good deal of contemporary international humanitarian and international law is a response precisely to the Shoah, to the Holocaust, to the appalling Nazi attempt to exterminate the Jews. And now you have people in this... I think shameless attempt to defend indefensible behavior by the state of Israel.
There is
attacking those structures of humanitarian and international law. Hmm.
There is a sophistication behind this. I mean, you mentioned Erwin Kotler. He was the co-founder of something called the Canadian Parliamentary Coalition to Combat Apartheid.
To combat anti-Semitism.
Anti-Semitism. And it seems like, is there a function that goes simply beyond, to put it bluntly, ignorance? I mean, is there, who is being served by this language, this manipulation of terminology and language? Who benefits?
Oh, well, I think the people who benefit are the elites who control state policy in the state of Israel. Some of the governing elites in countries like Canada and the United States, I suppose that Christian Zionists like Stephen Harper believe themselves to be benefiting from this kind of rhetoric. It's interesting, though, that Kotler would say it's the new anti-Semitism that is sophisticated. He'd say old anti-Semites were just a bunch of brutes. They'd say they'd whip up a pogrom against Jews with some fatuous but disgusting and horrible lie about Jews killing children, or that's the blood libel. That's one of the foulest tropes of anti-Semitism. And he would say the new sophisticated anti-Semites accuse the state of Israel of spilling the blood of innocent Palestinians. People using this new anti-Semitism rhetoric would say that's a sophisticated form of the blood libel. And it's quite interesting, Stephen Harper, in his Knesset discourse just a few days ago, said much the same thing. In the Western world, anti-Semitism, he said, takes on a more sophisticated form with some intellectualized arguments on some campuses. So he's picking up this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that reminds me of something called Israeli Apartheid Week. And I've noticed in centers right across the country, including here in my city of Winnipeg, a student group that would host Israeli Apartheid Week, they actually were able to delist it from that student union because they of the concern that it was evoking a lot of sort of anti-Semitic sentiment, although that claim appears to be groundless.
Yeah, that claim is really, I would say, not really groundless, but disgraceful. There is, and I noted it in the book, Anti-Semitism Real and Imagined. There have been serious studies. One of the more important ones was published in 2009 by a group of South African legal scholars and jurists examining the question of whether Israeli policies in the occupied Palestinian territories constituted colonization and apartheid. And they said, yes, yes. Now, I would think that Canadians ought to be able to take the word of South African legal specialists as to what apartheid is or what apartheid isn't. I mean, nobody's saying that what Israel is doing is the same as what South Africa did, precisely the same as what it did during the apartheid era. But some South Africans, Desmond Tutu, for example, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, have said, after visiting the occupied territories, this is worse. The suffering, the oppression, is worse than what people endured by his experience in South Africa. So, I know, for Canadian politicians or university administrators to glibly say, oh, use of this term is an incitement of some sort, is, I think, a very dangerous attack on, I would say again, international law. Apartheid is defined, together with colonization, in international law as a crime against humanity. Mm-hmm. And in effect, what those people are saying is, you may not deploy this term in international law. It's ruled out. It's an obscenity. It's whatever. It's hate speech. And that's I think really dangerous. But there's another sense, though, in which I mean, you asked, who does this serve? I think one also has to ask, whom does it damage? And obviously, it's intended to damage people who are active in the cause of Palestinian human rights and civil rights and political rights. But I think it's also, in a way that people sometimes don't realize, it's intensely damaging to Jewish people. And In the book Anti-Semitism Real and Imagined, I suggested that there's a kind of feedback loop. Because what you have under the new anti-Semitism is people like Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu saying, I'm not just Prime Minister, I am leader of the Jewish people. He's used that expression, as the leader of the Jewish people, etc. Now, of course, there are lots of Jews in Israel who don't like the thought of him leading them as their prime minister.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't want, if he's going and bombing Gaza, dropping white phosphorus on Gaza, or, conducting some other questionable deed, that, this idea that the Jewish people don't necessarily want that to be their representative.
Well, exactly. And of course, a large number of, as I'm sure you know, human rights activists in Canada and elsewhere are very precisely Jewish people. And they're opposed, adamantly opposed, to those policies.
One last question, if I might.
Yeah.
What about, are we talking about a new McCarthyism? I mean, this idea that, criticism of Israel, Israeli policy has effectively become more than just an intellectual argument, that it's...
Oh, of course, yeah. I mean, it's fraudulent, it's intellectually fraudulent in exactly the same way that McCarthyism was, because it's based on falsehoods. And it's based on a dangerous identification of the Jewish people worldwide with a state, and then a claim that anyone who criticizes that state is attacking the Jewish people worldwide. And then, of course, the worse that state behaves, the more criticism there is, the more evidence the exponents of this new anti-Semitism claim, the more evidence there is of a surge of anti-Semitism internationally. And, of course, the real danger is, behind all this, that for the real anti-Semite, who is prepared and already believes vile things about Jewish people, that person's prejudices are going to be, if anything, confirmed by the lawless violence of a state that the anti-Semite believes, because Netanyahu tells him so, is to be identified with Jews everywhere. You see, so that's a kind of really, that you have perverse feedback loops here that perhaps without realizing the damage they're doing, people like Stephen Harper are contributing to.
We've been speaking with Professor Emeritus Michael Kiefer from the University of Guelph, Professor of Literary Studies, and also the author of Anti-Semitism, Real and Imagined. Professor Kiefer, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me on the show.
And that marks the end of our show for this week. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.